We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
What we believe about the Bible is based on what we believe about its source.
The God Who Speaks, the award-winning documentary from the American Family Association, is now available in a special limited edition DVD set. This release includes a Sunday school curriculum and 2 hours of additional footage. Go to thegodwhospeaks.org to get your copy today. thegodwhospeaks.org. Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Monday, February 10th, and good morning to everyone who actually woke up and is at work on time this morning and didn't choose to sleep in because of the Super Bowl yesterday. But if you're listening to the rebroadcast of this later, you know, it's okay. I don't blame you at all. I know a lot of people who stayed up yesterday, and it was great to see that President Trump was actually at the Super Bowl. But the best commentary this morning came from an account on X called Sweet Meteor of Death. He says this: never realized how much the Chiefs depended on funding from USAID. I laughed about that and posted that on my social media. But Donald Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to actually attend the Super Bowl yesterday. Congrats to the Eagles. I know my uncle, who is originally from Philadelphia, is very happy about that. So a shout out to Uncle Arnold there. And Donald Trump also kind of reinstated a longstanding tradition of doing an interview during the game that was then played. And Biden has skipped that for the last couple of years, and I think we all know why. But Trump sat down with Brett Baer, and he talked about why he actually came to the game. This is cut one.
I think just the spirit of the country, the country's taken on a whole new life. I thought it would be a good thing for the country to have the president be at the game.
And I think that was reflected in the just phenomenal applause that he got when the camera panned to him during the national anthem. It felt like we were kind of back, maybe, as a nation. I mean, the NFL has had a lot of boycotts from Christians and conservatives over the years for being so phenomenally woke. And maybe the tide is turning just a little bit. I was very surprised to see Nike actually have some commercials that were very much pro just women in women's sports, and kind of saying, hey, let's put the past behind us. So maybe a little bit of an overture of recognizing that America First is back. And Trump also talked with Brett Baer about Elon Musk and Doge and what he wants to accomplish. This is cut two.
And I've had a great help with Elon Musk, who's been terrific.
Bottom line, you say you trust him.
Trust Elon? Oh, he's not gaining anything. In fact, I wonder how he can devote the time to it. He's so into it. But I told him do that. Then I'm going to tell him very soon, like maybe in 24 hours, to go check the Department of Education. He's going to find the same thing. Then I'm going to go to the military. Let's check the military. We're going to find billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of fraud and abuse.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to that. And so, of course, the left has been panicking. Senator Elizabeth Warren actually posted a video yesterday complaining that Donald Trump went to the Super Bowl and saying, you know, he needs to buckle down and start fulfilling his promises. And I was just laughing at how pathetically insane the whole left is while Trump is basically, with Elon's help, attempting to thoroughly dismantle the administrative state. This is the best possible use of his 4 years that could be achieved. But how exactly did we get here? Because even just a couple of weeks, I mean, this is now 3 weeks into his term, and he's already creating massive change just by shedding light in Washington. And this really didn't happen in his first term as much, because I think that he, like probably a lot of other conservatives, kind of went into D.C. expecting that there were some good faith actors, that, you know, we may disagree on policy, but overall, you know, we'll cut some red tape here and there, but the government runs fairly efficiently, and, you know, we can use some of these organizations to better benefit conservatives rather than just shutting them down. I think that one of the reasons that Trump 2.0 has been so successful, even in its first 3 weeks, is because they were prepared well ahead of the inauguration for their transition team to use the benefit of what Donald Trump discovered in his first 4 years and actually be prepared on the first day to hit the ground running. And there is a piece that was recommended to me actually by a couple of people last week that I want to actually read this morning and take the time, because it is so good. And it is on Substack, which is, of course, one of those alternate, almost like blog postings where you can read and subscribe to, you know, some of your favorite writers. Like we have Pedro Gonzalez on a lot. He writes a Substack called Contra. I'd encourage you to subscribe to him, support his independent journalism. But there's a lot of independent journalists that put their content on Substack. So this is one by Echo or EKO. And I'm going to preface this by saying I don't know the full accuracy of who this is in terms of where they're getting their information. But it's so good because a lot of this has actually been reported in otherwise in the public. And this is just basically an explanation of how well prepared Elon and his group was to go in and start dismantling the administrative state. So even if a couple of, you know, details or some of those things haven't been reported in other outlets or whatever, this is one of, I think, the best pieces that I read last week. And why the left, I think, is so panicking about these young programmers that are coming in and actually finding where all of the money is going. And it was very ironic to me to say that they're yelling and complaining about the 19 to 22 year olds who are working for Doge and saying, well, they're not qualified and they're not experts and they shouldn't be having access to the Department of Treasury files and all of this, when that's the very same leftist party that's wanting to lower the voting age to 16 and think that 16 year olds are perfectly competent to exercise the right to access the franchise of voting. And so, of course, there's total hypocrisy on the left. It's just they want to confine the American people and our government to only do what they want us and the government to do, which is, of course, to serve their ultimate purposes. And so we saw even a federal judge that has now put an injunction against Doge. We'll see how that ultimately plays out in court, but trying to prevent Doge from accessing the Treasury's websites. But I think a lot of frankly, the truth has already been unveiled, and that's a really good thing. So this piece is titled Override: Inside the Revolution, Rewiring American Power. So it starts with the clock struck 2 a.m. on January 21st, 2025. In the Treasury's basement, fluorescent lights hummed above four young coders. Their screens cast blue light across government-issued desks, illuminating energy drink cans and agency badges. As their algorithms crawled through decades of payment data, one number kept growing: $17 billion in redundant programs, and counting. We're in, a Cash Baba message to the team, all of it. Edward Korenstein's code had already mapped three subsystems. Luke Farader's algorithms were tracing payment flows across agencies. Ethan Shoutran's analysis revealed patterns that career officials didn't even know existed. By dawn, they would understand more about Treasury's operations than people who had worked there for decades. This wasn't a hack. This wasn't a breach. This was authorized disruption. While career bureaucrats prepared orientation packets and welcome memos, Doge's team was already deep inside the payment systems. No committees, no approvals, no red tape, just four coders with unprecedented access and algorithms ready to run. The beautiful thing about payment systems, noted a transition official watching their screens, is that they don't lie. You can spend policy all day long, but money leaves a trail. That trail led to staggering discoveries. Programs marked as independent revealed coordinated funding streams. Grants labeled as humanitarian aid showed curious detours through complex networks. Black budgets, once shrouded in secrecy, began to unravel under algorithmic scrutiny. By 6 a.m., Treasury officials began arriving for work. They found systems they thought impenetrable already mapped, networks they believed hidden already exposed, power structures built over decades revealed in hours. Their traditional defenses, slow-walking decisions, leaking damaging stories, stonewalling requests, proved useless against an opponent moving faster than their systems could react. By the time they had drafted their first memo objecting to this breach, three more systems had already been mapped. "Pull this thread," a senior official warned, watching patterns emerge across Doge's screens, "and the whole sweater unravels." He wasn't wrong, but he misunderstood something crucial. That was exactly the point. This wasn't just another transition. This wasn't just another reform effort. This was the start of something unprecedented. A revolution powered by preparation, presidential will, and technological precision. The storm had arrived, and Treasury was just the beginning. Personnel is policy. For decades, this principle, articulated by conservative strategist Trobe Hemingway, remained more theory than practice. Previous administrations spent months, even years, trying to staff key positions. Trump's first term barely saw 100 political appointees confirmed by February 2017. Every delay meant another victory for the permanent bureaucracy, but this time was different. While media focused on campaign rallies and political theater, a quiet army was being assembled. In offices across D.C., veteran strategists mapped the administrative state's pressure points. Think tanks developed action plans for every agency. Policy institutes trained rapid deployment teams. Former appointees shared battlefield intelligence from previous administrations' failures. By inauguration day, over 1,000 pre-vetted personnel stood ready, each armed with clear objectives, mapped legal authorities, and direct lines to support networks. This wasn't just staffing. It was a battle plan decades in the making. "This is the new normal," Vice President J.D. Vance declared from his West Wing office, studying real-time data flows across agency systems. "He's having the time of his life," he added, referring to the president's relentless drive. "We've done more in 2 weeks than others did in years." The secret, though, wasn't just speed. It was precision. Instead of waiting for Senate confirmations, the transition team prioritized non-Senate confirmed positions. While Democrats prepared for traditional confirmation battles over cabinet posts, an army of aligned personnel was already moving into place. Strategic positions were identified. Legal authorities were mapped. Support networks were established. "We don't have a lot of time," the president reminded his team daily. 4 years is a lot of time in political life, but it's not a long time in real life. The urgency drove innovation. While DOJ's young coders breached Treasury's payment systems, pre-positioned legal teams neutralized resistance within hours. When career officials tried revoking system access, they discovered DOJ's authority came from levels they couldn't challenge. When leaks surfaced, rapid response units fed counter-narratives to alternative media almost instantly. "When you look at the people surrounding the president," Vance noted, "we're trying to make it sort of easy for him to do what he wants to do in government. When you have an entire team firing on all cylinders, you can get a lot done." The permanent bureaucracy never saw it coming. They were prepared for resistance. They were ready for protests. They had plans for leaks and legal challenges, but they had no defense against an opponent who had spent years preparing for this moment. This wasn't just about filling seats. It was about a machine, building a machine designed to transform American governance. Every position mattered. Every appointment carried weight. And behind it all stood a president counting down not years or months, but weeks and days, driving his team forward with relentless energy. The foundation was set and the revolution was just beginning. So this section is called The Spread. USAID fell next. No midnight raids this time. No secret algorithms, just a simple memo on agency letterhead, quote, "pursuant to executive authority." Career officials panicked, and for good reason. Created by executive order in 1961, USAID could be dissolved with a single presidential signature. No congressional approval needed, no court challenges possible. With just one pen stroke and 6 decades of carefully constructed financial networks would face sunlight. Pull this thread, a senior official warned, watching Doge's algorithms crawl through USAID databases, and a lot of sweaters start unraveling. The resistance was immediate and telling. Career officials who barely blinked at Treasury exposure now worked through weekends to block Doge's access. Democratic senators who had ignored other moves suddenly demanded emergency hearings. Former USAID officials flooded media outlets with warnings about, quote, institutional knowledge loss and, quote, diplomatic catastrophe. But their traditional defenses crumbled against Doge's new playbook. While bureaucrats drafted memos about proper procedures, the young coders were already mapping payment flows. While senators scheduled hearings, pre-positioned personnel were implementing new transparency protocols. While media allies prepared hit pieces, Doge's algorithms exposed decades of questionable transactions. The scale was breathtaking. EPA climate initiatives, not just mapped, found unauthorized programs in 47 states. Education's DEI maze, not just exposed, revealed coordination across 1,200 programs. Intelligence community black budgets, not just traced, uncovered patterns hidden for 30 years. The administrative state runs on two things, a senior advisor explained, watching patterns emerge across Doge's screens. Control of information and money flows. His eyes tracked new connections forming in real time. We're not just exposing their networks, we're rewriting their DNA. The cracks began showing in unexpected places. A career EPA director, tears streaming, everything we built. A USAID veteran, hands shaking, they're inside all of it. A Treasury lifer closing his office, they move faster than we can think. Across Washington, officials who had weathered every reform since Reagan began quietly updating LinkedIn profiles. A deputy director, open to opportunities. An agency chief, exploring new challenges. A bureau head, time for change. Doge's algorithms weren't just programs, they were archaeology tools, excavating decades of buried networks. Each data point connected to another. Each discovery revealed new targets. Each pattern exposed larger systems. It's beautiful, one of the coders whispered, watching connections form across his screen, like watching a galaxy map itself. For the permanent bureaucracy, this wasn't just change. It was an extinction level event. Their power came from controlling who got paid, when they got paid, and what they got paid for. Now those controls were evaporating like dawn burning away darkness. The pattern was devastating in its simplicity. One, map the money flows. Two, deploy aligned personnel. Three, expose the networks. Four, restructure the systems. By the time the bureaucrats drafted objections to one breach, three more had already occurred. The revolution wasn't just spreading. It was accelerating. The impact. The first bulldozer arrived in Springfield, Ohio at 6 a.m. on a Tuesday. By noon, three blocks of notorious potholes were filled. Local news crews arrived to find not just construction crews, but data analysts with laptops mapping every dollar spent against real-time progress. This wasn't just road repair. This was a revolution in action. A woman grabbed the analyst's arm, tears in her eyes. 12 years, she whispered. 12 years I've been calling about these potholes. He turned to his laptop, showing real-time data flows. Look, he said, your tax dollars actually working. She stared at the screen. Wow, she whispered, it's really happening. Across America, funds once lost in administrative mazes suddenly found their way to actual problems needing solutions. In rural Tennessee, broadband expansion projects, long buried under bureaucratic red tape, broke ground overnight. In Michigan, water treatment plants received upgrades that bureaucrats had studied for decades but never approved. The transformation was measurable. In just 2 weeks, tens of thousands of redundant programs identified, billions in waste exposed, hundreds of unauthorized initiatives halted, countless local projects unleashed. But the real metric? Trust in government rising for the first time in 50 years. The revolution spread with surgical precision. Real-time tracking replaced quarterly reports. Algorithmic oversight replaced review boards. Local solutions replaced federal mandates. Results replaced process. He's done more in 2 weeks than Biden did in 4 years and Obama did in 8, Vance noted from his West Wing office. But this isn't just about speed. This isn't just about tech. This isn't just about personnel. It's all three perfectly aligned. For ordinary Americans, the impact was undeniable. Roads repaired, schools revitalized, water purified, but more importantly, something else was being restored. Trust. For the first time in generations, people saw their government not as an obstacle, but as a tool for positive change. The permanent bureaucracy had long operated on a simple assumption. Presidents come and go, but they remain. That assumption now lay shattered, replaced by a new reality. When preparation meets presidential determination, nothing is permanent. They thought we'd slow down, Vance said, studying real-time data flows across agencies. They thought we'd get bogged down in process. They thought we'd play by their rules. Instead, we're just getting started. The new dawn. The sun rises early in Washington. On this morning, its first rays caught the classical columns of the Treasury building, casting long shadows across streets still quiet. But inside, beneath the marble and granite, screens glowed blue. DOJ's algorithms never sleep. The administrative state was built over decades, a senior advisor explained, watching new patterns emerge across the displays. Built to resist change. Built to outlast presidents. Built to preserve power. He paused, tracking a particularly interesting data flow. But they never imagined this. They built walls against political attacks, defenses against media exposures, shields against congressional oversight. They never prepared for algorithms that could map everything, for personnel pre-positioned everywhere, for a president who counts every week like it's his last. The numbers tell the story. In Treasury, networks mapped, waste exposed, systems rewired. At USAID, decades of hidden flows revealed power structures dismantled. Across agencies, redundancies eliminated, algorithms, authorities rather, realigned, and missions refocused. But the numbers aren't the whole story. Imagine changes coming to a community near you. Springfield, Ohio, potholes that had plagued residents for 12 years actually disappeared overnight. Rural Tennessee, where children can finally connect to high-speed internet their parents were promised decades ago. In Michigan, people truly drink clean water while bureaucrats' memos about, quote-unquote, studying the problem gather dust. This isn't just reform. This isn't just change. This is American governance reimagined. The pace is going to be the same, Vice President Vance declared this week. It's just the priorities that are going to change. The permanent bureaucracy built their administrative state over decades, brick by bureaucratic brick. They thought it would last forever. They thought it was too big to map, too complex to understand, too entrenched to change. They were wrong. Four young coders with laptops proved that. 1,000 pre-positioned personnel proved that. A president counting weeks proved that. The sun continues rising over Washington. Classical columns still cast their shadows. But inside those buildings, everything has changed. The administrative state finally met its match. Preparation plus presidential will plus technological precision. This isn't the end of the story. This is just the beginning. The revolution isn't just continuing. It's becoming the new normal. And for those who thought the deep state would rule forever, they're about to learn what happens when smart strategic minds meet determination, when preparation meets opportunity, when a new generation decides it's time for change. The storm isn't just gathering, it's here to stay. The sun continues rising over Washington, but now for the first time in generations, it illuminates something new. A government that works, a bureaucracy that serves, a system that delivers. The revolution isn't just beginning, it's already won. And I don't know about you, reading this piece, that got me fired up because that's exactly what needs to happen. And we got to take a break here, but we're going to be right back to talk more about dismantling the administrative state and how a bureaucracy that serves is absolutely the institutional legitimacy that the biblical worldview intends for government. My pastor talked about this yesterday on Sunday, and just tying together and connecting those dots is incredibly important to understanding why dismantling the administrative state isn't just an America First priority, it's actually a biblical absolute that we have to require from government. We'll be right back with more.
Thank you.
If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and I'm already getting a lot of requests for from people who want to read that article, and I will post that on my X page and Facebook pages as well as soon as the show is over so that you can have that and listen to that. And of course, we will also post the podcast version of this episode at AFR.net so you can listen if you prefer again there. But when we're talking about the administrative state and we're talking about how exciting this is, that the dismantling of this deep morass of bureaucracy is finally being exposed and then hopefully eradicated, because light pushes out darkness. That is a biblical principle as well, that sunshine is the best disinfectant. We can go to the book of Micah, and this is where my pastor was yesterday. And I love when things come together like this, because I was already thinking about this whole concept. And then yesterday we're going through this sermon series called Built to Last, and how we exercise as Christians our faith in action. And this particular sermon title was talking about serving the community. And the tie-in here for me was when this piece was talking about a government that works and a bureaucracy that serves. Service and being statesman is completely lost in Washington. Everybody there, by and large, I mean, there are a few people, of course, the Christians that go. I mean, I was one of them that was very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, like, okay, God is sending me and I'm going to do good in Washington. And then you kind of meet this just morass of evil. And it's so much more dark and sinister than you could possibly believe, than I believed before going there myself. But this whole idea of service is completely lost, because the people generally who go there are wanting to use government and use power ultimately for their own means. And this isn't just American bureaucracy that, you know, that our founders left from when they came from England and they said, we want religious liberty, we don't want the government telling us what to do. I mean, that has come, that long train of abuses has been throughout human history. And then as we've seen the American bureaucracy rise, this isn't a new thing. This is throughout every government that has existed. Our founders recognized that power contradicting power was necessary so that we don't have just one individual with so much power that they can abuse it at whim. And yet we have, even within our government system and our separation of powers, we have the bureaucracy that, beyond politics being built to outlast presidential administrations, that was what kept Trump from accomplishing as much in his first term. And so when the Bible talks about some of these other instances of government abuse, taking the authority that God himself delegates to the institution of government and abusing it, is one of the worst things that those in authority can do. And if you look at the three institutions that God has ordained, church government, civil government, and family government, the abuse of authority of those who are in power in those institutions, those are some of the worst ways that we can perpetuate sin and inflict sin, our own sin, upon those who are under our authority. And this was happening during Micah's time, who is one of the prophets, and as my pastor mentioned, who lived the same time frame as Isaiah, which is very interesting. But the date would have been 735 to 700 BC. So this was over 700 years before Christ even came. And the injustice of the social evil that was occurring at that time with the government bureaucrats who were telling their religious leaders to tell the people God said, and telling the people who had inherited land from their ancestors, and God had literally given the land to these people, the religious leaders were then telling the people, well, sell your land. That's the good thing. That's what God wants you to do, so that then the government could come in, take their land, and basically abuse the people. And so it was a total racket, right? This was something where the government was abusing their authority, the religious leaders were abusing their authority, and ultimately the people suffered. And so the book of Micah, God's judgment and his wrath is against them because they have abused their authority for their own profit. And God hates the abuse of evil because of injustice. And when we think of a government that is designed to promote human flourishing, to promote freedom and liberty, to promote and protect the rights that come from God, it's not just because it's in our best interests as we the people. It's because that is part of God's own authority that he has given to these institutions so that they can carry out his justice on earth. And so if you think about how original sin was the rejection of the ordered authority of God, and saying this is what we want to do in our own will and our own image, it's a rejection of God's ultimate authority. And this is the biblical reason that the administrative state in America today in 2025 needs to be abolished. Not just because, you know, I don't want to pay as much tax, or because I think taxation is theft, or because I think that capitalism is a better policy, or because, you know, get off my lawn, or, you know, some of these other maybe rational and maybe even valid reasons, but it's because it is a biblical principle that government is under God's ultimate authority, and that God hates the abuse of his people through the authority that he has delegated. It is illegitimate authority. And the people who were in government and religious leaders back in Micah's day reflect the very same mindset of people in American bureaucracy today. The politicians and the religious leaders, even some of them, if you've read Meg Basham's book, if you haven't yet, you need to, Shepherds for Sale, because what they're doing is coordinating together to abuse the authority that God has given. And we're all pretty familiar with Micah 6:8, which says, "Mankind, he has told each of you what is good and what the Lord requires of you, to act justly, to love faithfulness," or mercy in some translations, "to walk humbly with your God." That is what we need to require from our government. This dismantling of the administrative state, I hope and pray, is effective so that we can return to a legitimate form of government that recognizes God's ultimate authority, and that he gives us our rights, and it is the obligation of government to preserve and protect them. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. So we've been talking about this whole dismantling of the administrative state and why it is a biblical principle that government acts with only the legitimate authority that God himself granted for the purpose for which he granted it. And that, of course, is to preserve and protect the rights that God gives each and every one of us as human beings made in his image. And in a well-functioning government, that's the purpose and the mission of what government is designed to do. It's not for its own purposes. It's not for the benefit or the wealth of those in power. It's not so that we can have this elite class versus the lower class, and we can have this stratified structure. And this is what our founders originally intended when they created this whole idea of self-government, that we the people have our own rights that God has given, and that we then delegate specific practices and processes and power to government to operate. But when government abuses any of its powers, then we can reform government as the people. And we have, by and large, I think we understand that concept as at least conservative Christians. We understand self-government. I mean, we have a lot of very patriotic Christians that are in this country, but we often, I think, don't really take the theory and apply it in practice and really understand what the Constitution is as an amazingly brilliant document. And for those of you who have been listening to this show regularly through the, you know, now we're into our third year that this has been on air, or who have, you know, followed me since I wrote my book 10 years ago, which is incredible, actually, that this is the 10-year anniversary of my book, The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution. You have heard me talk about this a lot, because this is the central key, that if we do not understand what our rule book actually says and the limitations and the separations of power that it provides, then we will not be effective patriots and effective advocates for our government. I mean, the reason that Trump 2.0 is so much more effective than Trump 1.0 is because Trump now understands the rule book. He went in so much more prepared this time than the last time. And that's just, that's, I think, expected, because he didn't know what he was going to face coming in. And this is why the left did absolutely everything, including two assassination attempts, to prevent Trump from taking office again. And that was the moment, I think, in Butler, Pennsylvania, that it really hit me personally how much the left just absolutely does not want accountability. They are, immediately, they filed lawsuits against DOGE. They're trying now to dismantle DOGE. And thankfully, we have now Pam Bondi, the AG, but we also have attorneys general on the state level, including Attorney General Andrew Bailey, who's been a frequent guest on this program, who posted on X, "Radical leftists are moving to dismantle DOGE. I will file briefs in court to defend President Trump's constitutional authority to run the executive branch." And he attached a Politico piece that's titled "First Lawsuits Against Trump Admin Target DOGE." So there's going to be a fight. And we should not, as excited as we are, as excited as I am, that DOGE is going in and totally rewriting the playbook, and they're taking the administrative state off guard. That's not going to just happen overnight, that the administrative state and the giant bureaucracy just says, oh, okay, well, you know, hey, it's been a good like 60-year run, but all right, you know, we're done. No, these are people who are genuinely evil at their core. Because they, like what the book of Micah is talking about when it goes through this history, and when it's talking about how the politicians and the religious leaders of that day were so corrupt that they were willing to use their power for evil. That's what's going on in America. And so we have to understand what our Constitution actually provides for. And this is why understanding our founding is so incredibly important. Because if we understand how our government is actually built and designed originally, then we can see how it got so far off track. And then we can start to have some of these solutions by, like DOGE is doing, rewriting the playbook. We have to not just advocate within the structure and within the system, but advocate for a return to a government led by we the people. And this was one of the things going through law school, which is ultimately what led me to write my book. Going through law school, it was so fascinating to me and frankly irritating to see how lawyers, even future Christian conservative lawyers, are taught to advocate within the structure, not of the Constitution, but this second Constitution, which is basically an interpretation and manufactured doctrines from the Supreme Court. So our Constitution is no longer just, you know, a few pages that you can go see at the National Archives. Part of the big administrative state bureaucracy includes not just what is hidden and that DOGE is currently mapping and all of the excess waste and spending, but all of the false doctrines that the Supreme Court has invented out of thin air over the last especially 50, 60, even 70 years of Supreme Court precedent. And they would like you to, as a lawyer, advocate, and as even as a patriot, to say, well, you know, the Supreme Court says, so, you know, thus saith the Supreme Court, and therefore it doesn't matter what the U.S. Constitution says. It only matters what the doctrines manufactured by the nine rogue justices are. They're part of this vast administrative state. I mean, if you look at the ruling, and I read it, that came out, I think it was Friday or Saturday, from the federal judge with this injunction against DOGE, it was ridiculous because it was total activism. It wasn't grounded in law. It wasn't grounded in the Constitution. I mean, it completely ignored Article 2 and Section 1 that says all executive authority is vested in the President of the United States. And so DOGE is not this unconstitutional outside agency or panel of advisors, which is what the left originally, in their very first lawsuit, day one, they said, well, DOGE is unconstitutional because it's outside the federal government. They had no idea that Trump was simply using a panel that was established by Obama just for totally different purposes and basically renamed it. So it's still within that structure, and it's part of the executive authority. And when you have all of these different agencies under the executive, ultimately they report to the chief executive. And so for the administrative state here and the bureaucracy to oppose accountability from their own head chief is utterly preposterous. And it violates every notion of, first of all, just accountability and fairness, but also the structure of the Constitution and to have the separation of powers. I mean, this would be like saying we're objecting to a congressional committee that was created under the legislative branch and their own rules that govern their own proceedings. And we're saying that that's unconstitutional because we don't like what they're doing. I mean, it's absurd. Now, you know, and we've had other legal scenarios like the January 6th committee, for example. There were a lot of objections there because that committee actually violated the rules of the legislature that they had set for themselves. But often then, of course, the bureaucracy said, well, you know, then it's not for the judicial branch to go in and tell the legislature how to govern itself. Your remedy here is to appeal to Congress itself, right? We're not going to touch that because, hey, separation of powers. But then when it comes to something like what Trump is doing and what DOGE is doing, very fascinatingly, right? Now the federal government says, oh, well, under judicial review, we have the power to say what the law is, and we have the power to tell the chief executive how he runs his own agencies, and he can't possibly go in and look at the books of something that he's supposed to manage himself. I mean, it's like the CEO coming in to a company and saying, okay, I'm here to run you guys more efficiently. I am now running this company. I've been hired by the board to do so. Open your books. And the accounting department files a lawsuit and says, no, the CEO internally can't even do that. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. But the reason that the left is so confident that the judicial branch is going to side with them and they've run out to get their injunctions and file their lawsuits and get these orders from these judges is because they know that the federal judiciary is part of the deep swamp and the administrative state. And I am hopeful that maybe our Supreme Court in its current composition and posture will recognize the opportunity that they have to actually follow the structure of the Constitution and follow what the Constitution actually says, what limited power it provides, and the restraint that it gives textually to the judicial branch, and they will use this opportunity to allow the executive branch under Trump to do exactly what it constitutionally is allowed to do, which is to run itself and look at the administrative agencies. And if Trump wants to say, you know, with the stroke of his pen, USAID is gone, well, you know, too bad. That's what the people voted for. There should be under no possible theory a lawsuit that is successful only because people are mad that something that was created with the stroke of a pen is then dismantled by the stroke of a pen. I mean, Elon Musk even posted on social, live by the sword, die by the sword, right? I mean, that's actually a biblical principle too, that, you know, kind of taken out of context there a little bit, but the point remains that if the executive bureaucracy was created outside the bounds of the Constitution, then no legal appeal to the Constitution should prevail, because they've been operating well outside the bounds and the structure of the Constitution anyway, and now they're going back and saying, oh, this is unconstitutional. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. And this is why the point here today, through this whole thing and this whole conversation we've had this morning, is that the administrative state should be dismantled. It is a biblical principle, and also we the people have to understand our actual structure of the Constitution so that we can have valid, legitimate arguments for showing the left exactly why Trump has the authority to do exactly what he's doing. Because this isn't a policy question when it comes to these challenges. I mean, they're arguing policy because they're saying we don't like what Trump is doing. Well, too bad for you. We the people elected him and you didn't get Kamala Harris. So sorry about that. But they are trying to morph it into a constitutional question, saying that he can't. Because remember, the difference between a legal constitutional question and a policy question is that the constitutional question is, can the government agent, in this case the president or the executive, can they do they have the authority to do what they are proposing to do? If the answer to that is yes, well, then they can do it. The policy question is, should they do it? That was everything that Trump campaigned on. He campaigned on the policy, saying we should dismantle the administrative state. We should have accountability. We should direct our taxpayer dollars to actually be working for the American people. All of those things are right and good, and are policy arguments. The left is trying to make this into a constitutional question, saying that no, he cannot. They are flat wrong on that. Yes, he can. They're only remedy here is the policy question. And that is a political question that the judiciary, a long-standing political question doctrine, says that the judiciary should not interfere with. They cannot answer the policy questions from the bench. That is activism. This federal judge who is putting this injunction against Doge is answering the policy question from a leftist activist mindset. That is judicial activism. And the remedy to that, by the way, if you look at the Constitution, is firmly grounded for Article III judges, is grounded with the legislative branch. They have the ability and the power. They can impeach judges and remove them from the bench if they are activists and they go outside the scope of their authority. If there were more federal judges like this Doge judge that was impeached and removed, then maybe some of these federal judges would care more about keeping their jobs than they would be these ridiculous activist opinions that they're using their power and their lifelong term to advance policy instead of protect and preserve the U.S. Constitution. So I would love to see the Congress and the legislative branch firing on all cylinders as well. Get some impeachments going for all of these lifetime tenured judges that are abusing their authority. We have to return power back to the people where the Constitution says. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.